Okay.
Also, say, the guy from the
Yeah.
He's talking.
Oh, it's great.
I told you.
Oh, no, I that went through. He went through and like, I have Yeah, that's what needs to fly. Just leave them out. The people only have 1 hour.
How are you today? I am doing well. How are you today?
Worst day ever. Just dragging. Dragging along.
Just dragging along.
Take the boat though.
Yes, you do. That's exciting.
They're not going to let you vote?
I. No, I'm not voting. Yeah, no.
Do you vote for anywhere?
No, I don't, actually. I don't.
You're on the SA, though, right?
No.
You're not on the SA? So I'm you're just on the elections committee?
Yeah.
But not on the... Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was probably... That was...
Yeah.
It may not have been that much fun.
It was an experience.
It was different.
Yeah, it was very different.
Ooh, what is that fancy thing?
It's a camera.
Of course it's a camera. Okay, I'm gonna go get the paper bag for my mail.
I don't want it to get me. So what did you mean by sitting here? Kind of. Good enough.
Yeah, I would be
worried. How do we turn this thing on?
What I really want to do is
Okay.
Besides the napkin, it's inversely proportional to the mess of the night.
You want me to get you another one?
No. I mean, thank you. I can always run it.
We need liquid refresh.
Hi, Marie, how are you?
Hi, Vicky, how are you?
Is he busy having a beer?
So when that thing came with the
was that this past fall? It just seems like some shut stuff by
the first meeting.
Yeah.
I didn't even have a name. Well, playing
if that's what you want to do, Matt.
I would just like you know.
I appreciate it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But because it was my first day, I didn't say anything.
You made up. You made up. But I mean, in a good way. You know, yeah. Not in a dominated way.
I thought Gabe was really, really good.
How are you again? I don't think I got an answer. How will you be in the summer?
Well, let's see. I have one conference in the middle of the day, another one first week in June.
Mm-hmm. After that,
I need to practice in the fall. Mm-hmm. I need to work on it. And then I have my own real research. But doing my own research. Yeah. So,
That's good.
Right now, I'm just on
hold. We have a record number of people. I predict we're gonna go over.
So how are you?
I'm good. Busy, but ready for this.
So you were a rising sophomore. So.
An experience. It was a real experience. I can't even remember. It was chaos. A lot of part was good.
Academically speaking, it was good. Socially speaking, it was good.
Everything else was chaos.
Like your sleep schedule.
My sleep schedule was pretty chaotic. That was chaotic.
I would say, okay, let's see if we can get late 60s or even 70s in Chicago. And it was,
oh, we can the ballots for that out there.
Yes.
And I know what they are. It was really suspicious. I had the straight deadline in the last 2 years.
Matt did mention that he does know. I mean, I can figure it out. But
Matt! Yeah. Well, Taglia! We're just going to... Taglia!
Yes.
Rena.
Yeah.
There he is.
Oh, perfect.
I'm just log into my email on this computer. I'm just gonna get in the email so I can get it.
Hey, Laura.
Okay.
Is there a computer to present?
Isn't it this one?
I don't think we can.
Matt, I don't think that matters. I don't think we have a computer that matters.
Yeah.
Here you go. All right.
We're going to try to get started. We're already running 5 minutes behind. So everyone can just take their seats. That would be excellent. Great. So, Carell, can you call the roll?
Anderson?
Here.
Battaglia?
Present.
Bensel?
Here.
Cone?
Here.
I see. Cotman?
Yeah.
DeRoos?
Here.
Fitch? Guido? Hatch?
Here.
Howarth?
Here.
Kaufman?
Here.
Kim? Cruiser? Lowe?
Here.
Michael?
Here.
Quinn? Schott? Van Loan? Wiggers? Winarto?
Here.
Okay, thank you.
All right, 13 present. That's more than a quorum. So with that, we will begin the meeting. So the first is the call for late additions to the agenda. Does anyone have any late additions to the agenda?
I don't have a late addition, but I have a question. Why is it that we have a presentation, I'm not posting a presentation, but 30 minutes that takes place at the very beginning when we have so many resolutions?
That was the only time they could come.
Well, I understand it's the only time they could come, but the fact is that the assembly business is such that we really ought to take care of resolutions that have been on the table for quite a while. Presentations are really important. I understand that, and it's part of our role. But the fact is, this is the last meeting of the semester. If we don't get resolutions that we have had on the table, this is a presentation. Does it require a vote? Is it something that we have to actually say something, that will contribute to the ongoing mission of the university immediately, or?
So I think that the reason that this organization, this report has been kind of prioritized is because of the tremendous community feedback that we've been receiving. So it might not take the full 30 minutes, but that your question actually brings me to a late addition that I actually wanted to propose, which is having another meeting next week so that we can finish the unusually large quantity of resolutions. So does that help resolve some of the problems?
It doesn't resolve it until we have agreement of the assembly that they will come for a meeting next week.
Yep.
If they do, then I don't have the objection any longer. But right now I still do, because I think we ought to get through the resolutions that we have and not have them lag on over the summertime.
Yeah, I agree. So I'm going to put a question as to whether or not we want to have another meeting as a late addition to the agenda, and then we can debate about that after we've exhausted the rest of the meeting. Does that sound good to you?
Oh, I think we ought to decide right now.
Okay.
Because I really think we ought to curtail the presentations prior to that time and then come back to them thereafter, rather than have them dominate. I know this is taking a long time, but I think it's important enough. We have a certain number of things that we had on the agenda for a long time.
Okay, so in the interest of time, we're going to do the late additions after we've done everything else. And we'll try to get through everything, and then if we feel like we need to have another meeting, we can vote on that. So that's what we're going to have to do. So are there any other calls for late additions to the agenda? Matt?
Well, I just had a minute or two to talk about the UHRB application situation. I think it's that's important. I also actually wanted to ask to schedule an extra meeting. I also had some other items to add, but the interest of knowing that our agenda already mathematically is approaching 3 hours in length, but the current allocation soon we don't go over. Well, I think we do need another meeting.
Okay, so we're going to discuss having another meeting as a late addition to the agenda. And the UHRB. So anything else? No? Okay, then with that, we will move into the Committee on Structural Organization in the Social Sciences. Thank you very much.
Thank you for inviting us. So my name is Judy Appleton, and this is my colleague, Ted O'Donohue. We've been the co-chairs of the Social Sciences Review at Cornell. So I have a question because I'm seeing a lot of familiar faces in this room. How many of you have already been in a session with us? Right, quite a few. So we're going to truncate a little bit the introductory bit because many of you have heard it already, and then we can get into the discussion right away and hear from you. The review of the social sciences started about 2 years ago with the formation of a committee to write a descriptive internal, a descriptive report of the social sciences at Cornell. That report was provided to an external review committee of scholars from other institutions who came in, looked at the report, met with a lot of people, and then wrote a report of their own. At that time, both reports were shared with the faculty. There was a period of comments. And then over the summer and in the fall, the provost convened configured three additional committees. The third committee hasn't been charged yet. That's a committee on administrative issues. These are all the things that really bother students and faculty about the way the social sciences work at Cornell. That committee will be formed later this year. The other two committees, one was an ideas panel committee. So this is a group of faculty who have been talking about research collaborations in the social sciences, and they're convening forums right now about social science research priorities, essentially. And then our committee, the committee that provided the report that you have asked us to talk about was on organizational structures. And that is the way the social sciences are organized at Cornell. And just to explain, give you a little bit of framing for this, there have been a number of reviews of the social sciences at Cornell over the last 50 years. And a common theme in those reports is that the whole of the social sciences at Cornell appears to be less than the sum of the parts. Now, what we frequently hear is that the social sciences at Cornell, we hear this currently, need more investment. And the faculty in the social sciences feel very squeezed. At the same time, if you look at the aggregate data on faculty at the university, social science faculty, those social scientists who are in what we call the social science department, comprise 27% of the tenure track faculty at Cornell. And there has been growth over the past 15 years of about 15% in the social sciences faculty. Whereas across the university and all the faculty, all the disciplines represented by the faculty, that growth has only been about 5%. So this would argue that there has been investment in the social sciences, but it's not felt. And so that is a suggestion that there's an issue with the way we're organized, that we're investing in social sciences, but it's not being felt. So there were a number of issues that came to the Committee on Organizational Structures. We worked from September until about February, where we sent a report to the provost, and that's the report that's being shared now. And but even though there were issues raised and problems that were identified, what this committee really focused on was thinking about how to position the social sciences to be outstanding 10 to 15 years from now. So it was a very high level thought process. We wanted to think about ways that we can ensure that we have outstanding research programs, that we have outstanding educational programs, that we're recruiting all the people we want to get, the faculty, the students, both graduate students and undergraduate students, and that we are a diverse faculty in the social sciences. And we had to keep in mind that the areas that are really important in the social sciences right now may not be the same areas that are important in 15 years. We had to think about structures that would enable us to be flexible and adaptive and position ourselves to be really, really strong in the social sciences 15 years from now. It was a very high level sort of activity. And so the ideas, and so there are a list of ideas in this report. Ideas, that word was chosen very carefully. They're not recommendations, they're not proposals, they're ideas. And we're asking everyone to consider those ideas, all of them. And the way the committee evaluated these ideas is just a way to think about this, is that we invited ourselves to walk into whatever that idea was and to look at it and think about what could happen here. If we did this thing, what could happen if we did it? And that's a really important feature of the process that the committee undertook. Two other things, we had a zero-sum constraint. We couldn't propose some enormous new endowment that was going to support the social scientists. We had to think about existing resources. And we also had to avoid thinking about obstacles, which is a very easy thing to do. So anytime people would start to say, well, we wouldn't be able to do that because, we have to say, we don't think about that. We think anything's possible here. So that just gives you a little bit of orientation to the report itself. And I probably forgot something.
Well, not much. I guess I'll just make a couple quick additions. One is, we do really want to hear people's feedback as you kind of walk into these ideas. Judy said, so please do send us your thoughts. I mean, both speak here today, but also send us, we have an email set up, ssreview@cornell.edu. So send us your thoughts as you think what you could imagine emerging from these ideas. In our report, they really are skeletal ideas. And then the other thing I'll just mention is, again, as Judy said, there's three committees. This is kind of a three-pronged approach of thinking about sort of where to invest in research, how to set up organizational structures, and how to deal with administrative issues. And different different prongs are going to have different value in different areas. So it's kind of a one-size-fits-all approach here. We're going to keep ideas on the table that could help. We want to think about where they might help.
Oh, and we are on a listening tour.
Yes.
This is one stop on a very long listening tour. And I'll just say that's the frequently asked question, how long will the listening tour last? How long will we be listening to input from the community? As long as it takes. So it may be that it just may be go into the fall. I don't know. But it's basically as long as people are interested in talking with us, we'll be listening.
Great. So if you have, you want to ask a question, raise your hand and I'll try to get you on the speaker list. First is Joe.
So I'm just going to address what everyone's been talking about. You've been to the student assembly, the graduate professional student assembly, had a couple meetings. Given all of, like, essentially the negative public feedback about the human ecology, ILR school merger, that you have ranked second, would you still today rank that second? Do you think the committee would continue to rank that second?
I certainly don't want to speak for the committee. We do want to be clear that the committee has dissolved. Judy and I are the only ones still ongoing. I guess all I would say is that I feel like we haven't heard that much in terms of thinking it through, but at the same time, I've certainly heard a lot of resistance. So, but in the end, it's up to the provost and the president, not us.
Linda?
Yeah, so one of the things that you said I haven't seen in any of the publicity surrounding this, which is imagining and conversing about social science, which to me, have you done any visioning around what actually that would look like with each school? So in other words, what's the future of work look like? What is the future of climate change? How does that impact people? That kind of thing where you start to think about what are the disciplines, translational research, you know, genetic ethics, these kind of things. Did you do that in your idea generation? To me, that's sort of where you have the potential to identify what are these emerging fields and then look at how to create the linkages. So to me, that would be the most interesting, because I haven't heard anybody say, you know, what are these fields? I don't know if you did it or.
Well, certainly the committee was comprised of faculty members from all across campus. Mm-hmm. And we did talk about the direction that fields are headed. So there's very much on their minds. I would say that the more specific question I think that you're asking, this is aligned very much with the ideas panels, right? So that committee, which has now had one forum on health, they're going to have another one on social justice, I think it's the next one. And then I think there's one on sustainability. I can't remember what the third one is. Yeah. So those conversations will go on there. And we've been asked why these things are going out of sync with one another. They were not intended to. Our committee got traction faster. That's all. It's a typical academic process issue. And so we're not quite coordinated in the way we intended to be. But that those things are being discussed now, and they're inviting a lot of feedback as well.
Yeah, just logically, it would make sense to align. Yeah. So in other words, look within each college to look at what their imagined social science would look like together.
Yeah, so the only way I would respond to that, in addition to what I just said, is to say that we were trying very hard not to go by college.
Okay.
We had a cross-college committee. We were trying to, we specifically asked people step away from your department and from your college. So that was very much part of the process. Yeah.
Richard.
My question is really off of Joe's. The ILR and College of Human Ecology merger is really, really unpopular with ILR. As you know, and to leave it on the table, I think raises unnecessary anxieties. So the question really is, how, even if there's just intense, almost unanimous, it's close to unanimous opposition to one of these proposals, is it still on the table and why? And who's going to finally decide this?
So the decision about any of the ideas will be made by the provost and the president. why is it still on the table? It would be the provost call to take it, take something off the table. And I think there are, so I understand that there's opposition from ILR because we've certainly heard it. But when we meet with other groups, there's actually discussion about that idea. Other discussion other than just straight opposition. So I think the provost is still trying to encourage people to walk into the idea and explore it. And maybe that can't happen in ILR, maybe ILR has already done that. But I haven't heard him say that he's taking something off the table yet.
Matt.
I was actually, I'm curious what is the biggest question for being here. I saw you last night, so I appreciate you're doing the listening part.
Like BFFs.
Yes. I guess just based off Richard's point, as an ILR alum, I actually been talking to a number of alumni colleagues of mine, and they are, first of all, they still think it's proposed, and it's not an idea. I was trying to clarify that. Last night, I encouraged, if possible, as much as possible, with the patients to try and clarify it's just an idea. But I think to Richard's point, there's a certain point where this is not necessarily beautiful, but either to clarify an idea and also almost to go like what the process would be for moving forward, because I know people say, oh, would it go through the faculty senate? Because our contract powers, would it go through the state legislature? And since people are going every which way because it's during 4 days of the war. And just to reiterate, I really appreciate you doing the speaking, but I think it's really, really good. I just want the clarity around it just to be an idea that I think we need to work on, because it just comes out as, I mean, in ILR, I know there was, I've received emails from former professors, I received emails from my colleagues. I received emails from people I don't even know in ILR saying, how can we just stop this? And I don't know what the other colleges are feeling. A few of my friends in my college are also opposed, but people think this is just an idea. People are gearing up to fight this as a merger that's leading the same thing right now. Just to be clear, that's not a sustainable approach.
Keep saying
that.
Thanks.
Chris, I had a few input. I was in the faculty senate meeting where also managed to be ILR faculty, very skeptical of the idea. I think one of these assumptions might not be considered, but another assumption has to be taken into account. As you say that what is successful now in social sciences might not be successful 10 years from now, 15 years from now. It's really important to realize that Cornell plays a role in how social sciences will look. Some of the steps you propose will either go against or it will change the current, so that will result in another state of social sciences 10 years from now. And so I think one thing we can take from ILR faculty is that ILR is such a special program, and that it might be within within current trends like across the country to like consolidate these types of social sciences. But maybe what ILR do like that is currently a beacon for research into labor. And might continue to be so 10 years from now. That it might not totally make sense to just bow to the trend as it seems to work at other institutions that point out that Cornell is special and that Cornell could be actually changing the outcome at 10 years from now. And then secondly, obviously the committee is already dissolved, but I think it might be problematic, not like empirically, but to just have faculty from all across campus, because the majority of faculty from all across campus thinks might be best for individual colleges, might actually not be best for as well as in them. So, like, particularly given the reaction from ILR, it seems like the majority of professors who aren't in ILR thought it was good to merge with college, but ILR didn't think so at all. And so, even if the intention is to make like the sum of all the individual parts stronger, that might actually not work. You might be making individual parts actually weaker tomorrow. That's full information from them just the individual parts in ILR. And then finally, I think the main criticism that came from faculty and the faculty senate meeting is that there just isn't enough evidence. Like, you're telling faculty to like go in and explore this idea, but I really think that like, the onus should be on the committee to provide like really strong evidence, a really strong argument for something like the merger, and then come out and end it. But even if it's just an idea, I have to say like, oh, we have this like big idea based on like broad trends currently occurring in social sciences across the country. Like, it should be this is the evidence we have specifically for why. These very specific curriculums that exist between these two colleges should be merged together and not loosely merged together. Friends, like you guys were looking for it. Obviously, that runs the risk of receiving very intense criticism if you don't have a very strong base in your setting. So, sorry, that's very long, but something like this.
A community member, Dave?
Yeah.
And then what's What's your name? Johnny. Johnny? Okay.
So I've heard this multiple times. And I deeply understand and respect the fact that you're putting that is that, but I think you're underestimating the extent to which community process, the administration in this whole process, either first of all the experiences in this school. Second of all, the fact that you have things to listening to, but we don't know what that even means. So you're listening until we stop talking about what you're waiting to hear. You've heard overwhelming competition from our students, faculty, and staff. You mentioned that there may be this discussion in other parts of the university. I don't know if you mean college of Gynecology or some other college would be involved in this merger, but the fact is that IOR is one of the main colleges involved in this merger. It's almost unanimous opposition to this. I guess I'm wondering what you're waiting for, and if this really is an idea, then having some kind of timeline for when we'll start this, what this will look like going forward. Some guarantee that the overall composition of faculty and staff, students in Iowa, will not be overridden by law school boards, would be a great help. Rather than just saying this is an idea, showing this is where you are in the process by laying out the steps to go forward and to let us know. Some kind of guarantee that it won't be done.
So I'll just, Ted, I'm sure, has his own way of responding to this, but I would respond by saying we've heard a lot about the ILR-CAG idea. We haven't heard very much about the other ideas. We're really hoping to hear about the other ideas. Some about the graduate field proposal, some about the center proposal, but there are, I can't count exactly, but at least four other ideas in there. And we're really hoping to hear about all of them. So if you're asking, you know, how long will we keep going? I mean, I'm hoping that we'll start to hear about other ideas. Right now, what we've heard primarily about is that one idea, the human ecology ILR idea, but there are some other ideas on the list. We'd love to hear about others. And I would just add that if none of these ideas appeal to you and you're really interested in the social sciences, please make a suggestion. Please make a suggestion for how we could organize the social sciences at Cornell to be absolutely outstanding 15 years from now. We would love to hear suggestions.
I guess the only other thing I would add, I mean, in terms of the sort of fears, is the provost has said several times that if any of these ideas start to, via the feedback, sound promising, the next step is not going to be a decision. It's going to be getting the more detailed study that a lot of people seem to be asking for.
Do you still have to leave at 5?
Sort of.
Okay, so maybe. Okay.
I think you guys have other business.
We do have lots of things that we need. Yeah. But there are a couple more people on the speaker's list. So, Marty, you were actually on the speaker's list.
That's ironic. I just want to say that for a long time, through the years, to give me an example, there was lots of debate about merging development sociology. It used to be called rural sociology with sociology. And back 20, 30 years ago, I don't know. And it was said, no, these are separate activities and so forth. Now it turned into development sociology. It's even closer to sociology in the sense that we're all going through processes of development. Urbanization is occurring everywhere in the world, globalization of everything. And it would seem to me that the center is a marvelous idea because it puts people in contact with each other the way programs put people in contact with each other, like the Southeast Asia program has people from different disciplines talking to each other about being the common problems for individuals, for people on the ground in places. And the social sciences are dealing with that. Why not treat people like people everywhere and get people who are working in respective well-defined areas to talk to each other about commonalities in their processes across departments. You would start across colleges, not merging colleges, but starting across colleges like programs do. We have people from agriculture, we have people from
you know, like human ecology in Southeast Asia. I'm just using it as an example. This is when I've had experience with for 40 some years. That seems to be a way to start. And then, you know, colleges can meld or they can fall apart. Thank you. It's the time's up.
Yeah, but if you have to go, it's okay. We understand.
No, it's fine.
Okay. Yeah. So the next person is Johnny.
Yes.
Yeah.
Hey, so I'm a grad student in ILR as well. And I actually agree. I think there are potentially some other ideas from the review process that could be potentially really good. The problem is, right, that we have this one idea that's taking up all the time. And I think it's just really, because it really directly impacts people like Dave and me and a lot of the Iowa community, we're going to keep bringing this up, keep people what we talk about. We're going to have to stop on that. I guess what I want to say is, this has really created a lot of kind of stress and frustration for me personally, because it kind of directly impacts my academic career. I was entered into the professional master's program this past year, decided to transition into the PhD program, and after I sent in my, you know, acceptance letter, 2 weeks later, this report comes out. Now I have no idea, and there's just a lot of stress and anxiety around, what is this degree even going to look like? I just committed 5 to 6 years to this. And I think it's also, as it's already been mentioned, ILR is totally opposed to this idea, right? Students, 88% of faculty, staff, both former and current administration. And this kind of just leads me, I know you guys have heard a lot of this, but it leads me to my next point is really, and I did read the idea and I read the review, but what is the real rationale behind this merger beyond the fact that these are two multidisciplinary schools associated with New York State? I really have not seen what is the real rationale behind this. If we decide we're just taking these two schools that are associated with New York State and merging them together, speak a little bit to that.
I think it's in the report. I haven't looked at the report lately, but one of the things the committee certainly discussed was the issue that was raised by the external committee is that the social scientists on campus are very, very distributed, right? So the number of colleges that have departments that are largely social science departments is very large by comparison to the institutions that were represented by the external community. And so right now we have a large number of social scientists in the College of Arts and Sciences, we have a large number in the Business College, and we have social scientists in human ecology, CALS, and ILR. And the idea is partly a massing exercise, where you would be bringing together a large number of social scientists into one college. And that would create some kind of balance across the university for the distribution of the social sciences. That's a very simplistic way to think about it, but that is at least one rationale for this. It's a massing effect.
Okay, well, that exhausts the speakers list. So thank you so much for your
time.
This is just a reminder, if you want to give feedback, you can email them at ssreview@cornell.edu. So feel free to send your opinions about that. Thanks again for being here. So with that, we can move on to the Judicial Codes Counselor Annual Report. And thank you for being here. Yep, this way. Feel free to start with
Kendall. I'm Kendall Carr, the outgoing GPC. I'm also a third year law student. For those of you who aren't familiar with the JCC office, we advise students, faculty, and staff under three different codes here at Cornell: the Campus Code of Conduct, Policy 6.4, which is Cornell's classification of Title IX, and the Academic Code. This year, our office has been contacted by 162 individuals seeking guidance. Of those individuals, 61 have become Code of Conduct clients, 22 have become Policy Support clients, and 52 have been Academic clients. So we're a really busy office. Besides myself, there are three other staff members, another third-year law student, two second-year law students. As JCC, I've continued the client-focused approach of the office. We do a lot of work with clients, it's less of a policy position, although we do, I Our office is supported by the Office of the President. They always make sure we have enough printing dollars, and we have an office that is associated with that. Other than that, we're a very independent office. One area of growth that I've been working on as JCC is developing our institutional knowledge. So tracking what types of cases we're having, what the outcomes are, problems that are reoccurring, or trends that have been developing. After this report, I'm going to type up a memo. It won't be as extensive as the 2015 report that some of you might be familiar with, but I do want to make sure some of the observations and trends that I've noticed have been reported, so that if this body or other entities want to address those concerns, there is record of them. So I want to talk about first the academic integrity code. It's actually the code that I've seen the most problems with here at Cornell. It is, to put bluntly, kind of a procedural nightmare. Each school has a different version of the academic integrity code, and procedure is not the focus from what I've observed. I've seen an email between two hearing chairs where they essentially say procedural arguments don't have merit. I have seen procedure misapplied. Some schools don't let JCCs advocate for their clients, and some schools do, so there's inconsistencies in student rights. So whichever class you get accused of, depending on what school it is, you have different procedural rights as a student. There aren't really timelines within the academic integrity code, so it's stretched out. There's also lack of specificity in what you're being charged often, and the academic integrity hearing probably needs better training in terms of what kind of procedural elements are required and expected of them, namely being the standard of proof, which is clear and convincing evidence at the hearing board, academic hearing board level, that's higher than a preponderance of evidence to be in the process. And in my most recent hearing, I had a hearing board member not know about that until my client brought it up. So because that's a code that this body doesn't oversee specifically, I encourage the conversation to be started about maybe a revision to that process. The faculty control is not an integrity code, but I think students and stakeholders should really be involved in revisions, because it's frankly beyond problematic. It's of serious concern to me, having been an outside perspective of this process, and it's something that's not widely talked about, like the things that have policy 6.4, in a word, I would sum it up to inconsistent procedures are very problematic in other ways, but the way the procedures are applied is very inconsistent. The office moves at a speed that, you know, it can, as best they can, but it's a very slow process. They had a bunch of staffing changes, and one positive thing that I've seen come out of that is that they're using outside contractors to investigate cases, and I haven't worked with one yet, but my colleague has said the outside contractors or investigators have been very efficient and really great investigators throughout the process. Hearing boards at that level don't have any precedent to reference like they do in campus code of conduct, so there's a wide variety in the sanctions that students are having imposed against them, and there's a lot of inconsistency in terms of how. Within policy 6.4, the JCCs play a very different role than they do in the code of conduct. We cannot speak at all. I have to whisper to my client to ask a question and then have him or her play top telephone and say verbatim what I said. Something as simple as, when will you get the transcript back to us, is something that I have to pass through my client to ask an investigator or the Title IX coordinator, which is very problematic because there are students on this campus who don't speak English as a first language, and articulating certain things can be really difficult for them, and not having an oral advocate on their side is a huge hindrance to their ability to advocate for themselves and have a fair process. I've seen that multiple times within policy 6.4. Also, not even English being a problem, but just being timid or nervous or scared because it's the first time that students have ever been in trouble or in trouble to that degree. So I think not having an advocate be able to actually advocate for you is a huge problem within the policy 6.4 context. Although we do a lot of written advocacy, which is a large portion of the policy And lastly, the campus code of conduct is actually the best code out of the codes that I work with, which is surprising. Has some problems, but is currently there's talk of a code revision coming up in hopefully near future. So hopefully a lot of that can be addressed. One thing that I want to applaud is the current JAA's goal of having an educational approach to sanctions. It's, I don't always agree with what she believes educational is, but I think educational is, but there is that goal, which I think is important. Going back to academic integrity, there aren't educational sanctions in that code. It's purely punitive in terms of your grade. I think AI would benefit by having students have educational sanctions. I had a freshman who didn't know that she had to study, who got a grade penalty, but then there wasn't a remedy in terms of helping that person learn where they really went wrong. So the JAA has implemented decision-making classes, which is a more tailored workshop than the basics of alcohol and drug education that is often imposed. And through the practice of indefinite suspension, which I think is a really great step forward. One thing that I don't think is educational is the reportability of certain sanctions. The JAA has a little bit of discretion and has chosen to match the reportability of student sanctions, such as probation, to match that of faculty. That means 6 years post-graduation, meaning if you get put on probation as a freshman, that's going to follow you for the next decade. So I think that's something that isn't educational, but very punitive. Additionally, this JAA has basically done away with oral warnings, which raises the floor of sanctions. So your first sanction for a low-level offense would be a written reprimand. And that means that if you get in trouble again, that's raising the floor of the escalation of sanctions. So that's a problem that I've seen over the course of this year and last year. They've also implemented a summary decision agreement by mediation. That's something that I'm undecided on at the moment, whether it's good or bad. It is a longer process for students to go through, but it does seem like more tailored sanctions, whereas most of the summary decision agreements that come out of the JAA are very cookie cutter and not necessarily specific to the student needs. And that's kind of my overview of trends and observations I've seen in my last 2 years in the office. And I'll definitely be writing a more extensive report.
Okay, so I have three people on the speakers list. If you'd like to ask a question, please raise your hand. First is Matt.
First off, thank you so much. It's been an absolute pleasure working with you over the past few years. I just want to publicly commend Kendall and her office. They do fantastic work. Kendall's been incredible in this office. And I haven't seen a bad JCC yet, but Kendall really is keeping up the very high standards of the office. But that's, I guess, also, and academic integrity is totally simple. I'm actually working on a resolution looking at how that interacts, because the UA, our charter, gives us jurisdiction over common standards of community conduct. And even though academic integrity is the faculty's, we are empowered to pass recommendations that look at it in terms of it's in the world's wider judicial system. Okay, my question is there anything in terms of your office is very heavily independent, and I personally think that, so I think the assembly shares my view. My question is there anything that we can advocate for you in terms of just policy changes, resources, or anything in general that
not specifically. One area of concern that I had that came up recently is I found out the JACC's role has been incorporated into other acts, like overseeing bias review in the student assembly. And I think the JACC office should be removed from all roles like that we might be in that I have no idea about. Our client focus that the office really should stick with. So that's my recommendation to get us out of all of that. And then procedurally looking at the code consistently and making sure stakeholders have a voice. But that's pretty big, so I don't have any specific to request to
Jung. All right, Jung, take note of that. next is Richard.
So I want to echo Matt. Kendall, you've been absolutely wonderful in this office. I really appreciate it. It's and the other thing I would say is everything you just summarized, I mean, I personally think is a good idea. Really write it up. I mean, you'll have an audience for it. So it isn't like you're
filing it in an archive that nobody's going to pay attention to. And that it comes from you, that counts. So that's it.
Yes, thank you. It's very cogent, concise, informative report. I have a question on the academic integrity code. It's faculty, but I don't know much more than that. Is it really, is the faculty senate, or is it college by college? You say there are differences across the colleges. Is that because the colleges are differently interpreting what the faculty senate wants, or is it simply that's really the colleges?
Each college has its own variation of the code that it follows. I don't know how it's revised or if there's control by the faculty senate to kind of centralize it. I don't know the politics of it, but I encourage you as a faculty member who has a voice on the committee to advocate for a close look at the way procedures are in our office.
That seems really important. I wasn't aware of it. Thank you.
Chris? It sounds like you do amazing work. I think this is just shocking inequities. I don't know how to do this, but that's access to public courses is being discussed. I guess the question that students have been right now is to generally add some public size and use that issue.
I'm not really sure what the essay does, so I'm not sure solutions to these problems. A lot of them are the problems start at the code that they're written in, so there's a lot of problems in before that sort of the advisors can talk to things like that. But I think just a general conversation so that students can become more involved in any revision. Most students who go through this process aren't going to talk about it. It's very, most people feel embarrassed that they've been cited for a violation, whether it's plagiarism or football. I've never had a client who really wanted to talk about the experience after it. So, just kind of generate feedback, maybe even in the forms where students who have been through this can talk about it. I know the JAA receives feedback from students after they go through that process. So
yeah, I just had a recommendation for one that you mentioned a couple of instances, not by name, students who you thought were unjust. So when you write your recommendations, I don't know how many there are, depending on whatever you can do, but a couple of them are an example of a student that was in this situation where it did not work out. So that gives a little concrete.
Some discussion in one of the sessions on about certain aspects of 6.4 or other being reincorporated. longer a 6.4 or an office that had to do that separately, that would certainly free up a good chunk of resources that might be used to bolster the campus, campus behavioral monitoring stuff. The other thing I wondered about is the sort of related to what Lindsay said, is that you talked quite a bit in there. Your references of the doctors to clarifying your report to areas that where the current judicial administrator or the judicial administrator's office, let's put it that way, seems to be performing in a particular way that may not be sufficiently leave enough room for adequate representation or proper representation of the client's needs. And I think you should be fairly clear about those things so that we can get some guidelines or think a little critically about, our responsibility, which is to evaluate the performance of the judicial administrator, make recommendations, and ask questions.
In terms of advocacy, the judicial administrator's office is probably the best one in terms of allowing advisors to advocate for their clients within the AI and policy. To clarify, because the
JA's
office is the one that actually tries to work with us
to those things. No, I wasn't referring, okay. I wasn't trying to pair the two.
Okay.
I was talking to two different
things.
Because there was a second report that you raised, the one about 6.4, I was just raising that as your recommendations might be somewhere in there about should there be a reincorporation of 6.4 into the campus or some elements of it, what might they be that could be affected by an office. The second had to do with a bunch of things you said,
okay.
which seemed to refer to the JA's office. I think it was something like peremptory or some kind of initial charge or something like
okay.
that.
Yeah.
Thank you.
And the final question will be from.
So, Kemba, you mentioned more training for the hearing board for the academic integrity. So, is there one central hearing board, or does each college have their own?
Each college has their own.
That's it. Okay. Yeah, each college has their own. Okay. Then with that, thank you very much for being here. So. Yeah. And I actually just want to say, from having worked with you for the past 2 years, you've done, from my point of view, an excellent job. Yeah. So I just want that reflected in the minutes. So, okay, great. So with that, we're actually going to move on to the regeneration of the judicial codes counselor and the reappointment for 1 year from now. So, Gabrielle, would you like to introduce yourself?
Hi, everyone. I'm Gabrielle. I'm in third year. And pending your approval, I'm really excited about
So, Matt, if you were the liaison to the committee, you would speak on the
yes,
process.
Absolutely. So, I'm pleased to inform the assembly that I'm very happy to see Gabrielle as the candidate. My estimation is she was the strongest candidate, and the process was conducted in a fair and impartial manner. And therefore, I see no reason, from a procedural point of view, that the assembly should not confirm her service beginning this year as an associate and 2 years, 1 year from the summer as the judicial counselor. I will note that there were some concerns. I did see about how the process was conducted. I raised them with Kendall as the current concern agency as well as the chair of the assembly. And we're looking at ways to potentially very familiar with those moving forward. However, I don't believe either of those or any of those concerns that noted rise level painting selection process. And that means that I have several elements of support and information. And this is an excellent job continuing the very strong legacy of service in the JCC's office.
Moving to confirm, Gabrielle.
All right, there's been a motion to confirm.
Second.
There has been a second. Is there any dissent to voting on confirming Gabrielle as the Judicial Codes Counselor for a term beginning fall 2019, expiring in summer of 2020? Okay, seeing no dissent, we will vote. If you are in favor of confirming her, please raise your hand. All right, if you're opposed, and if you would like to abstain. By a vote of 14-0-1, you are confirmed. Congratulations. Okay, great. So with that, we're going to move on to the next item of business, which is the consensual relationships policy vote. So this is a little bit trickier, and Elena, you kind of been able to look at this. So if you'd like to explain kind of what Charlie has asked us to do.
Sure. So Charlie has created the ballot that hopefully you all picked up at the front of the door before the meeting for the Faculty Senate, and he contacted us and we made the choice to use the name ballot. And so it asks that you sign your name and then vote which one of the two you are supporting or neither. And there's a little paragraph at the bottom explaining the difference between the two different policies. And then after this vote, I'm going to be taking and giving them. So
no, I'm collecting them, and then
you're what?
I'm collecting them, and then I'm gonna tally.
And then yeah. Someone is taking them. So your name is going to be attached to your vote, and that is going to be put on your committee final report. Just so you know that before you vote. Okay.
Yeah. So, Matt.
Short comment.
Oh, you'd like to make a motion?
And comment and a motion, yes.
Okay.
So first to note that our rules don't, this provision does not follow our rules. You can't have a different ballot vote. Our ballot is a ballot vote. So I'm very concerned that we're asking for names in that matter. Our rules are assembly. But that being said, I'm concerned about the process in that it doesn't really move folks to the answer to at all. And I know that the very fortunate to have Kendall talking about the incredible mess that policy 6.4 is. The fact that 6.4 has cost the university tens of billions of dollars in legal fees. And the fact that this policy, as Charlie himself said, this policy, the draft, will go to the president's office, and he literally quite said, and I quote verbatim, will go into a little black box and the lawyers will come up with policy and it'll be spit out and then you'll have policy. That is very concerning to me. Because I really this belongs to the next president. Full stop. The carve out for policy 6.4 is incredibly narrow. I went back and checked that carve out is only for instance of sexual harassment and sexual assault. Charlie has explicitly said this policy covers neither of those. And as a matter of fact, this point for carve out, the Working Group on Hate Speech and Harassment is actually actively investigating how to bring 6.4 back into the code because the code, where it's flawed, is the best vehicle we have. It's a community driven vehicle. And 6.4, with no respect to those who try and enforce it, is not a great policy. The fact of the matter is, Charlie said, oh, this goes into a black box. Well, if it goes in the code, it's not a black box. If it goes in a code, it has to go through the CJC. That is by definition, the community process, by definition, something that the community controls. And in my estimation, if we're going to vote in favor of this policy, we're actually also breaking our bylaws because we are implicitly ceding authority from the code. We're going to do that. It belongs, if that should go through the CJC. It should be done on the floor. It should be done through there. Furthermore, the fact of the matter is, Charlie argued that this shouldn't be in the code because it relates to employment matters. Well, for students, graduates, and undergraduates, employment or not employment matter, they're already under the code. But honestly, I don't think anyone can tell me having a romantic relationship with a subordinate is part of your job duties. To me, it just doesn't make sense. It's not. And therefore, when it's outside the scope of your employment and a student, it belongs in the code. The fact of the matter is, this is a code matter, it's a CJC matter. And to say that it should be outside of it, which doesn't be ceding more authority when the administration has shown that when we do cede it, things go wrong, to me is very concerning. And that's why, in addition to my concerns procedurally, I would formally motion that the assembly, whatever its sentiments, the assembly will indicate that it believes that all these provisions that are relevant should be in the campus code of conduct and not as a standalone policy.
I second that motion.
Okay, so there's been a motion to have the assembly express the sentiment that the assembly believes, say it again,
that all pertinent provisions of this policy should be housed in the campus code of conduct and does not consent to ceding it or removing them from the jurisdiction of the code.
Could you write it down?
I can't.
Okay. So can you get something written? We did. Yeah.
Where is Charlie? We let him introduce her as
Yeah, he did. Let me
look back.
I don't know why.
and then talk about that's probably shouldn't say that. Okay, Richard, while I'm pulling the email up.
Just very briefly, I support Matt's motion.
Okay, good. So here's, I'll read Charlie's email. I will not be at the UA today, parentheses, in-laws in town plus Sun Reporter at 4:30, hyphen, lethal combo, exclamation point. it would be nice to have the results in time for tomorrow's Senate. Otherwise, Friday is the hard deadline. Thanks, Charlie. All right, so that's why he could not be here verbatim.
So is that what Matt said about us voting something that is indeed clearly not allowed to be done?
So, I mean, like, as individuals, we're members of the University Assembly. I mean, the way you could read this is they're asking the members of the University Assembly to sign their name on, and their, you know, and their constituency department, and indicate whether or not they prefer it. Technically, we can vote however we want. I mean, I don't think, like, in my personal opinion, I don't see why this makes, like I voiced this at the SA meeting, like, my opinion, not on the actual policy, just, like, procedure-wise, it does not make sense to have people sign a ballot, because, like, there's no, like, you only sign things if there needs to be, like, accountability. And accountability upwards just means they get to see how we vote, whereas no one, like, none of our constituents will see how we vote. So I don't see why signing, like, why we have to sign. Like, Ellis?
I see the problem with both, but I think it should be reported the way our other votes are reporting. Yes, no, abstain, without specific names. I think if the university, if they're asking for my vote as an individual, then that has nothing to do with my seating on the university assembly.
Yeah. So, I agree with you, but this is what they've asked for. So there's a piece of paper, you can do what you want with it. I mean,
yeah.
Yeah,
I'm just going to follow up. This is what I got.
And yeah.
You can fill it out if you want, I guess, and give it to Sorrell.
The e-board's not going to compel people to fill this out. Like, it's on the agenda. If you want to fill it out, fill it out. You want to sign your name as whatever, you can sign it as, you know, a pretend name, Mr. Pineapple.
Lethal combo.
Everyone can sign it as lethal combo.
You can conceivably write on it that the CRP belongs in the campus code of conduct.
Yeah, you could write notes on it.
And just send it off that way and say the ballot is.
I wrote a little note on mine, right here on the back. What? Yeah, it said, because it says on here, this can be done physically by writing on the reverse or electronically via email to Dean of Faculty at Cornell. So I think everyone should just kind of take a moment to reflect on what they want to do with this piece of paper, and in about 2 minutes, in about 2 minutes, Matt will have language. And Elena, you can come around and collect, or I can come around and collect.
Yeah, and I will give them to Sorrell.
And we will give you the pieces of paper.
With whatever is on.
I'll collect them.
Okay, that's fine too.
Ready?
Yeah, if you're ready.
Are you going to eat that brownie?
Oh, yes.
Okay, now go get it.
All right. Oh, no. You.
There's my vote. Because you can try to grab another one.
I still have another
one. You can eat this one.
Yeah.
Okay. Here, take it off this plate so that I can use this plate.
I recycle.
That is fair. I will explain when the number does not add up that some members were either absent or chose not to cast ballots.
Oh, that's a good idea.
Which ones leave for the in-laws or the son? That would say the in-laws. I don't know his in-laws, but in general, they come off and be leave. Marty?
Yep.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thank you, sir. That's the pile.
What's that?
That's the pile of ballots.
Oh, you got it, Mark. Oh, you did?
Yeah.
There you go. Thank you.
We're all set.
Thank you.
You can live on this way.
So, how are you?
Just get ready. Okay, so Marty, did you submit all the ballots to?
I did.
Can I actually see them?
No, sure.
I'm curious because I just want to see how many people voted. Yeah.
There's people's names on there, you know.
Yeah, I mean.
Voluntarily or not.
Yeah. Cool. Matt, do you want to read through them?
I absolutely would love to read the language. The language that I have reported and open to tweaking is, and I quote, "The University Assembly strongly believes that these provisions belong in the Campus Code of Conduct and does not consent to removing them from the jurisdiction or adjudication of the code and university community."
Okay. Did you email that out?
I can email it by momentarily.
Yeah, just email that out and then you can consider it.
5 seconds of it.
Yeah. Okay, so there's a second. So we'll begin discussion on that as soon as it's emailed out to everyone, because I cannot write that fast. Well,
could you read the last phrase again?
Sure. I agree with the whole thing. I emailed very slow, but it is the University Assembly. Sorry. The last sentence was, and does not consent to removing them from the jurisdiction or adjudication of the code and the university community. In essence, because the code is a community document, it's controlled by the community, and therefore the policies are not community documents, they're controlled by the administration.
So I wonder if you could say the university community, which has jurisdiction over the code, because it's kind of odd about the code. It's actually the community that oversees or enforces the code or whatever, the police to the code or whatever.
Well, the university, your first words were right again. University Assembly.
Yeah. University, I can read the whole thing. The University Assembly strongly believes that these provisions belong in the Campus Code of Conduct and does not consent to their removing them from the jurisdiction or adjudication of the code and university community.
Their removal?
Their removal from, yeah.
Instead of removing them.
Okay. Yeah. So when that gets emailed out.
So if we can move forward, I'll email it out in a minute.
Yeah, could you, just you amended it. Perfect. So, Joe, if you want to speak.
Yeah, is that getting sent just to Charlie, or will Charlie, and we expect Charlie to send that to Martha Pollack, like, or should we just send that directly to President Pollack, like, bypass, because, like, I think that it would make more sense that we just send it to President Pollack, and also, because then, if we send it to her, and she's like, I agree with you, then we get the policy back, and then writing process, or you just choose not to write. But yeah, I guess like I just have a question on like where exactly we're sending this to.
I mean, we can send it anywhere we want by email. So I do want to point out for the assembly, though, when President Pollack spoke to us in November, she did say, she communicated to us, and I, correct me if I'm wrong, she said that if we do not agree on a policy, then the administration will kind of pull one from other schools and concoct one by themselves. So that's just point of reference. I think it's like important that everyone remember that. Bob, you were next.
Yeah. And then, two comments. One on that. The last time President Paul was met with us, I thought she walked back. I thought she wasn't going to step on our toes on that code of conduct. Point number one. Point number two, I would suggest if we pass this resolution to the president, also waive the faculty senate vote on it tomorrow, several of their senators, and I would be prepared to say, ask the senate before we vote tomorrow.
Okay. Alexa?
So that was a question I had, because I know that people probably voted on the last night, so how would that affect our vote and what we
The UA, we can send it independently. It would just be on behalf of the UA.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, Linda?
So should there be a careful resolve that the policy should be remanded to the CJC or whatever? I mean, it seems like there's a next logical step here.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good recommendation. So, I mean, there's no one else on the speaker's list. So, okay, Martin.
There is if we are having a meeting next week, everybody, then that would be an appropriate time to do the full resolution. I agree with Linda that there should be a couple of resolves, and the resolves should include some language similar to most of our resolves, which is that this be sent to the president and the provost and expression of our desire and will to send to the president and provost for their action, for consideration.
Elena?
So I definitely agree with you. I don't know for sure. I mean, Charlie's not here, so he can't correct me, but I think he has their committee's final deadline this Friday, I think.
Yes.
So I don't know if he would be able to.
Well, I think this, in a way, this is really going beyond the committee experience, because the committee is not going to say, we want this to happen, and it's going to happen. The committee is just putting a recommendation on what I think that's the way it works. And the policy has to be constructed somewhere in the legal offices and so forth. So I think by our putting our oar in, it may be that the policy they come up with is perfectly integratable into the campus code of conduct. It's just where it sits right now. I think, in fact, we could even add something for next week if we do this, which says that we also would like to, and Matt, you could probably draft it, have a more thorough discussion of the integration of aspects, given our experiences with the harassment and so forth, discussions that have gone on campus, that we have we consider integration of aspects of policy 6.4 back into the campus code of conduct. But Matt, you can work on that.
Yeah, so you have language?
Yeah, I do. Okay. I'm gonna read it, and before I start to circulate it, so I'm gonna read it now. Language is, the University Assembly strongly believes that these provisions belong in the campus code of conduct and does not consent to the removal of the jurisdiction or adjudication of the code, period. The Assembly believes this policy should remain in the control of the university community and not be removed from community control as an administrative need-driven policy.
Okay. Richard, did you want to speak on that?
So what? I think we should pass this resolution today because it's timely for tomorrow for the Faculty Senate. And then the one with the resolves, which I think Linda's comments are, I think it's easy to put that together because because Matt had a very cogent set of arguments for those resolves. But we do that next week. But for this, for today, I'd really like to see us pass this thing.
Okay, Ellis?
I'd say another way to handle it, given that there's going to be a vote tomorrow, is that as a faculty senator, I would be willing to stand up and report that as a member of the university assembly, we feel, could we, I could report a vote, that a more appropriate place for this kind of legislation would be within campus code of conduct and not a separate vote from faculty. So sit down. I'd be willing to faculty senator, I would do that. If, yeah, because with whatever vote we do today, okay, it's not going to influence tomorrow afternoon's vote in the faculty senate, unless it's reported to the senators.
Yeah. So what we have on the floor as a motion that has been seconded is the university assembly strongly believes that these provisions belong in the campus code of conduct and does not consent to their removal from the jurisdiction or adjudication of the code. The assembly believes that this policy should remain in the control of the university community and not be removed from community control as an administratively driven policy. So that's what we have. Matt, can you send it to the listserv? And then I actually had a question about this just to make sure. So currently, who enforces the policy on consensual relationships? Because is it currently enforced in the code? My impression is that it wasn't. So if it's in the faculty handbook, then we shouldn't say that it's been removed from the jurisdiction of the code. It might belong in the jurisdiction of the code, but I don't think it's being removed from it, for better or for worse. Manisha, did you have something you wanted to add?
Yeah. So for context, from last year when the resolution was being considered, it was being considered in response to a faculty senate resolution that was attempting to change language in the faculty handbook regarding relationships between students and faculty. And I think that the response part of the resolution called for a joint committee with the faculty, which is why the CRPC was formed and I did not vote to the CRPC. The resolution specifically called. I would also just ask, which they may have already been this, but is this something that Brad is on the state, whether it or not the agreement language, have wanted? And my question is, if it were to go to the PhD, how much longer would it take for there to be language in place to handle this specific thing? Because if it's going to extend that timeline, I don't know if Brad's going
to do that. To your point, perhaps forever, to be honest. We move slowly. Matt?
Just a note, I mean, well, broad set of our assembly. Did the GKSA last night asked the changes to make it a little more representative. But right now, the GKSA is overwhelmingly PhD candidate students. Does not adequately represent master's degree students or professional students. Speaking with other master's, I'm a master's degree student. Speaking with my colleagues, they had other concerns about this that were different than the PhD track graduate students had. And to note that, I mean, I watched the presentation, she helped me write a resolution to try and begin ameliorating that. But that being said, the current policy of the faculty handbook is faculty on students. This policy is considerably more broad. It could even be undergraduate on undergraduate. And that level of breadth belongs to the code. And if it was just purely faculty, the faculty handbook would likely be the correct place for it. By broadening it to any relationship where there's any influence of power or other influence, which could be an undergraduate TA to an undergraduate student, to me, they've widened the scope so much that it now is a code issue. It's not just a faculty. Yes, they're legislating among other constituencies, including ones that always fall under the code, which would be students.
Okay, so we're still debating this motion. So I don't have anyone else on the speakers list. So if there's no one on the speakers list, then as the chairman, I have to call for a vote on it or a table. Are we sure we're ready to vote?
So.
Yeah.
I would like to repeat Manisha's great question. Is if we were to handle this in the CJC, and how long would that? Because forever is not an answer. That's not an answer.
Yeah. I agree. It would be. I hope that doesn't happen. I mean, I don't know. It's however long the CJC.
So I understand that, you know, wanting to put it in the book. So I think I agree with that. But my second point would be the time, because I think Gretz really, really have wanted this for a while.
know then, Matt.
Yeah, I have to say that if this was a question that we had in this time, and I think, you know, people brought it up to Charlie at the beginning of this process, like, why did you not go through the campus code of conduct? Like, he didn't give an answer. And so, like, I do question, like, if we do go forward with this, like, what is the imperative for, you know, the CRPC to actually, you know, turn over language to the CJC and just say, you can try it by yourself, and then just do, like, a board before I recall. Like, we're fighting a committee that basically has the president's blessing, which is kind of, like, the similar level to the University Assembly. I mean, we're a little bit above that. But, like, we're just going to start, like, essentially, like, a shared governance drag race with CRPC, which, like, I don't know if that's something we have, like, any logistical power to, like, start, like, broadsiding a committee.
Matt, and then Dale, and then Mark.
So in terms of timeline, I think that's a very valid concern. You look at, for context, we are working with hate speech harassment. They are actually finalizing a report that will be CJC within the semester. CJC is considering, I mean, we've moved for about a year to get that relatively done. Actually, I've worked with that work, I've worked with quite frequently. In this case, I think the way to see this is the CRPC, to treat it similar to the work with the CJC charter. Their language comes to the CJC. Again, I don't personally think this language is in that bad of shape. I think a key, though, is it belongs in the code, and take the work from that to CRPC, put it to the CJC. I could see this being done by the end of the fall semester, assuming the CJC got up there, could start next year. But to me, the key is that I brought this to Charlie a number of times, and it was ignored. You don't get to remove things from the code by ignoring the CJC. We have, the thing is, again, to me, the most troubling concern is, Charlie has said this goes into the administration because of the black box policy. 6.4, the track record of the administration frankly botching a policy. To be blunt, I'm concerned that if something this does part of the black box policy, we're going to get sued over it because someone's going to say it's a Title VII violation or unequal enforcement because it should be under the code.
Yeah, so Dale, and then Richard, and then Linda, and then Mark.
I think in terms of the process, I agree much more with what Matt just said, but the CRPC has done everything getting input on the what I would suggest to the UA suggest to Charlie is put everything they do more concerned faculty members into the faculty handbook, but take everything else concerning other constituencies, and even the language they already have, and just have that be passed to the CJC for approval. I think language is already been worked on, the language has been worked on by the faculty, employees, undergraduates, and graduates. The problem is just that we don't want something going into the faculty handbook, but the faculty handbook doesn't have the power in that jurisdiction. You just tell Charlie to take everything else that doesn't involve faculty members and give that language to the CJC.
So yeah, before more people speak, I just want to clarify this, like the consensual relationships policy would not live in the faculty handbook. The current proposal is to have it live as an independent policy outside of both the faculty handbook and the campus code of conduct. And also just to clarify, like again, the current language that we have that has been sent says that we would be like, we don't consent to removing the adjudication of the consensual relationship policy from the code. Like, it is objectively not enforced by the code, so like I would strongly recommend that we change that language because it's not true. So like I have to point that out. Next is Richard, and then Linda, and then Linda.
Yes, I think it's really important as a precedent that we not give way to this kind of process in running the university assembly. When the president talked about this in the fall, she used the word usurp. She said that this policy was so important that she was going to move ahead, recognizing that there would be some ruffled feathers, some jurisdictional problems in doing this. And what we can do, I think Matt's pointing it to it with the hate speech. The hate speech, whatever their committee comes up with, is going to come back to the CJC, and we will report in the fall, and it'll go to the president in that way. The same thing could happen here. They could issue a report, but our claim of jurisdiction, our assertion of jurisdiction, just means that it comes back to the CJC before the president implements it. That word usurp That's a very strong word. That's her word. And it was a recognition that it was taking our the university assembly's authority.
Okay, Lindy, you're next, but Matt actually has something about the language.
Yeah, I appreciate these points. In terms of what I've heard, I tried to answer this out momentarily. The new language is the university assembly strongly believes that these rules belong in the campus code of conduct and does not consent to a course of action that would see them outside the jurisdiction or adjudication of the code. The assembly believes this policy should be in control of the university community through the code and not an administrative policy outside the code.
That's
what I'm going to insert right now.
Okay, yeah. That whether or not we pass it or not is up to the assembly, but it doesn't contain any error. So that's good. Okay, so with that, Matt basically functionally has made a motion to amend to have it read that. So is there a second?
Second.
There's a second. Okay, so we're debating the motion to amend.
What are we amending?
We're amending the original
language
to read what Matt just said. Okay, is everyone on the same page? Yeah? Okay, so is there any dissent to amending the language to read what Matt just read out? No. Okay, so seeing no dissent, the language has been amended to reflect what Matt is now about to send out. All right. He's about to send that. Okay, but Linda?
Yeah, so usually if we get something like this that we're not comfortable with the route that it's taking, don't we usually and refuse to vote on it and then come up with a resolution and say, whereas because this includes employee relations, it therefore has to go into our campus protocol. I mean, you have so many different whereas there is a terrible track record of policy 6.4 being removed from the code. I mean, you can write these whereases, four or five of them, and say, therefore, we want to have it expedited. You know, the results of the review of this committee should go to CJC, and by fall, we should move this. Shouldn't we table it and say next week we'll have a resolution? And the resolution would then be helpful. So we're just unwilling to vote on this because we're not happy with the procedure.
That's what I wanted to suggest with mine. I think I'm next on the list.
Are next on the list.
Okay,
yes.
Well, I wanted to suggest that, in fact, and I was going to motion the table afterwards, but I wanted to include in it because we had a report by the JCC who said that there are problems with this. We've also had concern expressed that this would slow down the implementation of it. I think if we have a comprehensive resolution that can handle the various issues of policies that are related to conduct and related to code kind of behaviors of people on campus that gets shunted out of the code and the code becomes very isolated, that's an erosion of the code. It also is creating, as Matt has said in 6.4, lots of conflicts, costing of money and so forth to people. I would suggest that our resolution be a little broader, but that this be used as an example of it's not just, what was your word?
Usurp.
A usurpation. It's actually an undermining of the governance system that's on campus. And that the resolution can have that factor in it. So what I'm suggesting is that we table this and get that kind of language more built in, especially based on your experience with harassment, that it can be more comprehensive as a result. On the other hand, but not on the other hand, but I want to suggest one, I know there's time, but on the other hand, there's one other question to bring up, and that is the immediacy of this. If we can put in the resolution some idea that there could be a stopgap, because actually 6.4 exists, right? That this could be a kind of stopgap that can apply until a more comprehensive integration of 6.4 and of these kinds of things occurs into the campus code. That's expressing the will of us of an overall solution, but it's allowing for the concerns
that are rightly expressed that there is no policy right now, or at least not a sufficiently robust one, if you want to put that way, such as this resolution that's going is offered.
Motion to extend by half an hour.
Second. There's a second. Is there dissent? Seeing no dissent, the meeting's extended until 6:30. I'm going to continue with the speakers list. So next is Rena.
So I would like to reassert the fact that the
TCSA
has waited 3 years to get this up. And I think that the fact that you're doing this right now instead of a year ago when this has been coming up, is a little bit, you know, I think it's inappropriate because, you know, the co-chairs are members of the committee. And, you know, we have been bringing up concerns to them. You know, if it were this big of a concern, we should have made this motion earlier. Everybody knows the timeline that they have, like that, right? So I don't understand why we're doing this right now when the votes are due in the committee.
I just want to know the timeline. I brought this up to Charlie, to Ms. Anna Waymack, Mr. Nathaniel Stetson, all on the committee multiple times in person and in writing from last year to the fall of this year. My comments were routinely ignored. You brought them up, they ignored us. So, I mean, I agree, this is poor timing, but the rubber has to hit the road. I think at a certain point where if we vote on this, we are tasked with letting it out of the code because that's what it's doing. It belongs in the code. The code is a standard community guidelines that apply to everyone, for students and staff, for students everywhere, for faculty and staff, and outside the scope of their employment. This belongs in the code. To Marvin's point, I am more than happy to write a resolution. I have a lot of resolutions to write. I'm happy to write one. But in terms of noting that the report is due tomorrow, and the fact that they said it is voting, the report is due Friday, and this text is voting tomorrow. I would ask if there are no concerns to either amend or approve this language, the very least today, should this go into the investigation, put in the current system. We're on the record of knowing that we want to do this so that we can take the time, the week, to draft a formal resolution to do it. I mean, for the graduate point, I mean, 3 years is a long time. But even what I brought before is I'd rather do this right than not do it at all. 6.4, but now it's over 4 or 5 years. And it's been framed with enough respectfully, it's been an unmitigated disaster. And I mean, that's why I think they're asking for a stop. Yeah, I think there's a lot of flexibility here, but I think the code is the right way to do it. But we can do what I've looked at in terms of the policy. We have in the past incorporated things by reference. And CRPC has a very wide tool to probably do this. And I think CRPC has done all the groundwork. You take the public information and through the UA's authority to request formal information from the administration, get all the information we need, plug it in. I can already see how it's written in the code the way that keeps it under community control and does not end up. Where the administrative policy, where the president could take this policy and then change it tomorrow if he wanted to. Shouldn't be a black box, it should be a community control document. This is community values.
Ellis.
The question that I have to figure out. If one looked at these individuals, a faculty member and undergraduate, that falls within the college of the dean of the college in which that faculty is a member. It has nothing to do with the CJC. Nothing. In fact, the college is responsible for the its faculty. So simply putting it into the code doesn't mean that the CJC or the code has jurisdiction over that kind of a problem. Right? Okay. Now, if it was an undergraduate TA and an undergraduate, that would go to the JA.
Yes.
If it was a graduate student, that might, I don't know where that would go. So I guess my question is that when you have these broad kinds of things, there's already something in the faculty handbook concerning appropriate behavior of faculty. Not specifically, this would create this other entity. Okay. However, I haven't seen anything to indicate how each of these particular situations would be parceled out to the appropriate authority for penalty. Okay. It's very easy to just say, well, you're not gonna allow this, you're not gonna allow that, but that only has meaning in the context of what's gonna happen if you're caught doing it. Is there a hearing board? A special hearing board? Are there special procedures? Are there that are all incorporated in the code? But I didn't see any of that incorporated things I read about this particular policy. That is doesn't exist. Have you seen it?
My understanding of reading the draft, it's laying on the enforcement.
Yeah.
So
That's what I thought. Anyway,
that's part of the concern here, that I think you can tell.
Matt. Yeah, so sorry. Manisha?
Regardless of what the body today does, the council president is going to vote on the policy and the CRPC is going to submit something to President Paul for the photos, which is why I would actually encourage that if the assembly so feels that we should be in the code, they should draft a resolution, submit that resolution, and submit to President Paul, saying we would like whatever her decisions or whatever her notes are on the code for it to come back to the CJC. But to reiterate, she seems to want language on this situation in particular, and if she's unhappy with the CRPC language, she may just do it herself regardless. So, I just to lay it out there, I think that this is moving and in motion. And to reiterate Rita's point, the two co-chairs were members or are members of the assembly, and a motion for a resolution on this could have happened months ago. So, I just don't really understand why it's coming out this last week. 2 days before the
battle,
or a day before the
battle. Okay, Alexa.
Yeah, I just really want to echo what Rita and Manisha have said. This is a really important policy for graduate students, especially. And I frankly find it inappropriate that it's just not coming up, that it's not being implemented correctly, like this was brought up months ago. And I think that it isn't, quite honestly, fair that we're debating this issue
after. Okay, Joe.
It does seem that some members of the assembly don't necessarily know the full scale of the current proposed policy. What you voted on is not the full policy. The full policy contains so much more. It involves the creation of an office that deals with this specifically. And that's what I think is being lost. We can't put the creation of an office in the campus code of conduct. This is a multifaceted conversation that, again, I think should have come up earlier. I mean, whoever's failing it was, that's the failing of that individual. I don't know those individuals. I don't know, because the individuals that are the co-chairs aren't even here, or don't even come to the assemblies when they vote on them to ask questions and expect that that all the information is already out there on a website. And so, frankly, there is concern about how process was created, but I don't see it slowing down based off of this specific motion. Again, I'm going to echo, like, I mean, this is, like, you could say this, the CRPC was blessed by the president, and this, and we're going to start drag racing it on shared governance. That's one area. The presidential task force, blessed by the president, obviously has some overlap with us, again, in the campus code of conduct. I mean, if you want to write a resolution saying this is something weird, it's something fishy that's happened with this current president, of her going to task force and blessing things other than shared governance units, that's the argument. The argument doesn't exist in this anymore. It exists at a grander scale, and that's something that people look back at.
Yeah. So this, I feel like this argument has become essentially circular, and so I'm going to ask the assembly to either vote to table the discussion, or we can continue having it. We are 15 minutes over and we haven't even touched the business of the day. So if we want to continue talking about this, don't vote to table. If you are done talking about this, vote to table, or if you're ready to pass it, then don't vote to table and then we can keep talking about it. So, okay, do people want to keep talking about this or no? So. No, so I'm going to make a motion to table. Is there a second? There's a second. Okay, well, I just made a motion to table, and the motion was seconded, and a motion to table is a non-debatable motion. So if you're in favor of tabling the motion,
you're closing discussion.
No, I'm not closing discussion. The motion to table is a non-debatable motion. Please raise your placard if you're in favor of tabling. If you are opposed to tabling, please raise your hand or placard. All right, I abstain. By a vote of 9-4-1, the resolution is tabled, or the motion is tabled until our next meeting. So we're gonna continue with the rest of our agenda. And we can pick this up at the end, or we can pick this up at our next meeting. Sorry that took so long. All right, so next. We're going to move on to
amend the agenda and move the call for the confirming Cornell's committed to ethical investments and financial transparency. redundancy to the top of the order of business. We have a guest who's here to speak on it, and we're over time, so I kind of close dates.
Yeah. Okay. Is there any dissent? Seeing no dissent, Zach and Chris, you have the floor. Thank you so much for your patience.
You can come up here.
I'm sitting next to
him. He hardly bites.
Yeah,
so start whenever you're ready.
Hi, how's it going? I'm Zach Schmetter, and we're here to talk about Cornell's commitment to ethical investments. I'm a bit crunched on time myself and realize there's a packed agenda here today, so I think we're going to just try to keep this focused on the key points and legislative factors to make sure this moves quickly. So, in short, a similar version of this resolution passed in the student assembly, mostly promoting divestment from Cornell's holdings in Puerto Rican debt, among some other things regarding transparency. This was conveyed to the president and then rejected due to the Board of Trustees guidelines regarding investment. Chris is going to speak after and kind of touch upon the ethics of the investment a little bit, but as of now, the president has made a hard rejection. So we brought this resolution to Campus Infrastructure Committee and talked about, well, how can we get students and the rest, faculty, grad students, and et cetera, more involved in giving input to how the university invests? Because we've seen fossil fuels, we've seen guns, we've seen Puerto Rico, and conveying the community's opinion is very important. So this resolution is acting upon the recent action of the University Assembly to reconvey the Budgetary Planning Committee and add this as an aspect, as a responsibility of the committee to have the Office of Investments be essentially communicating confidential details under a non-disclosure agreement with community members, faculty, staff on this committee to better bring more accountability to the process and bring community input in a setting that can facilitate discussion. And with that, Chris can talk a little bit more about Puerto Rico specifically.
So just briefly, real quick. So if Bravo's group does have investment in Puerto Rican debt, then we also know that the Department has made an effort to lobby the Oversight Board, which is in charge of Puerto Rico's economy. And so we believe that and then that's why we obviously submitted the resolution to the ESA for divestment, but that meets the requirement for divestment because, among other things, it presents a systemic endangerment to the children of Puerto Rico, the 60% poverty rate in Puerto Rico among its children, and the policies that are looking to be passed by the Oversight Board will only exacerbate that problem of poverty. There's a massive food insecurity problem in many cities. So Seth Klarman, by investing in Puerto Rico, won immediately after the passage of PROMESA, which was the law that created the Oversight Board that had obviously a leading towards creditors. And then two, lobbying that Oversight Board, which is only, Puerto Rico is only subject to an Oversight Board because it's not a state, it's an unincorporated territory, not unincorporated status was formed 100 years ago when the Supreme Court said that Puerto Ricans were too uncivilized to have equal rights. And so we believe that by profiting off of that unequal status, one, it's unethical, we're profiting off of racism and the idea that people are savages, and then two, you're by extension be complicit in the actions of an Oversight Board that is putting Puerto Rico an incredible threat to the well-being of Puerto Rican children.
So, in short, Chris just kind of presented the overall situation in terms of Cornell's involvement with Puerto Rican debt, but kind of looking at this from a larger situation and why the Budgetary Planning Committee would be a great fit for this resolution is that when you're like a student, you come to campus, you're essentially hit with so many guidelines, code of conduct in order to ensure you're behaving and conducting yourself in a particular way. And when you look at entities in BlackRock's ETFs or New York State pension funds, there are guidelines regarding how investments are to operate, or other endowments have guidelines on how a hedge fund manager should be operating. So I feel like Cornell's a little bit behind the curve of other public institutions. And I mean, as a student, I really don't know the best way to get community input and make the right decisions, but I think bringing together members of the community to convey these concerns to the Office of Investments would set up a communication channel where community concerns can be aggregated and then brought in a manner that's quote, respectful and productive, and then the Office of Investments can kind of look at these things and make the best determination of their investment strategy, which of course is confidential to a best protect Cornell's financial security in terms of generating a reliable, non-biased, volatile return, as well as looking at the ethics and the long-term sustainability of investments, whether it's regarding climate change, fossil fuels, Puerto Rico, and conveying concerns of the community.
Okay. If you have any questions or comments, please raise your hand or placard. I have two people on speakers right now. First is Joe.
Yeah, so one of the whereas clauses deal with UA budget planning, but I guess I'm seeing a mismatch in that because the budget planning committee's intent was not to directly look at investments. If I'm remembering correctly, sponsor of that resolution. So I think there's a mismatch in committee that you're looking for. And in addition, the committee is not staffed. So the timeline of this is questionable. I do wonder why the budget planning committee was not necessarily made to look over investments. The budget planning committee was made so that constituencies had an ability to voice their concerns about the budget that does not contain the investment. The investments are controlled by the investments committee, the office of the investments committee of the board of trustees. Those are the people that look at those investments. That's why the investment-based resolutions go to the trustees to debate, and not necessarily, and all the assemblies do that process is either send them to Martha Pollack, or send them to Martha Pollack. You know the policy. I mean, so I guess there's a mismatch in terms of all the clauses and the purpose of the resolution.
Hey, I want to thank you. I worked with both of Zach and help with us. In terms of the we added to our bylaw, the first item was pushing for longer budget planning. And to me, when I read this longer term plenty of benefits to include our endowment, either endowment provides our expenses, provides a significant portion of our day-to-day operating expenses, such that we can clear that community is very hard. Additionally, the budget planning committee is the only committee December that is set so that it's so heavily deeply confidential that it would be able to talk to things that would be approaching the endowment because the energy has a high level of confidentiality on that. So to me, it fits into its ambit, but it also has to also be more frankly with confidentiality, and that does fit. The government does include things. They're not going to just go to politics. And then in response, the president calls response to our prior resolution to fix it. That's why I personally think the budget planning committee. If they're going to disclose to anyone, it would be a small group of people who are signed to non-disclosure agreements. So the job is already to how the budget long term looks out, which means to wrap that up.
Just for point of reference, the year on average, or not on average, but this past year, the budget, the endowment was about 20% of the endowment returns represented about 20% of the budget, or 15% of the budget, but it's significant. Next is Richard.
So the guidelines in the resolve section, I'm skeptical that we could develop these guidelines, but let me ask a question to that point. So there is a Puerto Rican debt. It is distressed. Cornell owns a bunch of it. What should they do? And that, if you can't answer that question, then you're gonna have a lot of problems developing guidelines. So what should Cornell do with its Puerto Rican debt?
Right, so I can give you kind of the immediate answer and then the long-term answer. So essentially there is a group of US mainland hedge funds that pretty much bought out a significant chunk of one specific tranche of debt. So those hedge funds are trying to say we own most of this debt. Now we're going to put our area of debt to the top of the stack and max out repayment. So Baupost is like one of those. We might be in another one in the stack, but I mean, like everything's so, it's very hard to like actually learn facts about this. So, I mean, so divesting from Puerto Rican debt and saying, okay, we don't want this in the portfolio. Can you please sell this on the open market? So likely it could get picked up by an institutional investor or a diversified debt fund. So likely, because when debt's on the open market, I mean, who knows who's going to buy it, but the hedge funds that own the specific tranche of debt, like, I mean, they could buy it up, they couldn't, but the point is, it shouldn't be part of Cornell's portfolio, and if all college, so as a public institution, along with the other ones that comprise, like, Baupost portfolio, if there is less of a demand for public debt, then these hedge funds won't be buying so much of Puerto Rico's distressed debt. So that's the short answer, and it gets pretty complicated, but in the long term, we invest in a lot of hedge funds that are essentially using a risky investment strategy where they're going to find so for instance, with the Greece strategy, Baupost was also an investor in the bankruptcy of Greece. So Goldman restructured all of Greece's debt. It went bankrupt. And then as it was going bankrupt, Baupost bought into this. And then they essentially hire a bunch of lawyers like they do with Puerto Rico to go in and push their chunk of debt to the SOC. So, I mean, one, you're essentially trying to max out a repayment at the expense of a bankrupt country, which it has a lot of implications for like education spending or rebuilding of Puerto Rico. But also from the university perspective, like setting up guidelines in terms of like what we want in our hedge fund portfolios, because I mean, that's also very risky. So like to have a chunk of your endowment in peril and a bunch of lawyers like in another country, like trying to negotiate what cents on the dollar you're going to get back. When you have an endowment, you want like a very reliable, smooth return that you can predict to map out in the budget. And I mean, some of this distressed debt investment, you're not going to get your return for 10 years. So it's very volatile, it's not smooth, and it's also pretty risky.
It sounds like you just want a prohibition on junk government debt.
Well, I mean, not a complete prohibition because, so like if you're investing in an actively managed hedge fund, then they're doing a lot more than just holding the debt. They're also lobbying for the restructuring of the government. So say like, if you look at like a BlackRock diversified debt fund, they simply would be scooping up the debt of 100 different countries and holding it in a passive manner. So it's kind of, it's a different type of investment with different diversification and risk. And a lot of that has different implications. So that's kind of part of the idea of bringing people together on this committee to establish a dialogue on what would be the best policy for Cornell to approach distressed debt. And so a lot of times there's really no formal policy, but informing the Office of Investments how to essentially what we would like to see in their dialogue with hedge fund managers, because when you're working with an alternative investment vehicle like Carlyle Group, so like if you have $100 million and you're investing in Carlyle, your portfolio looks different than Virginia like public schools pension who also invests in them. So I mean, you're able to work with these managers to talk about like what your preferences are. So I think like getting the community to kind of give our take too. And then the endowment office, of course, is the one who executes on it and can kind of strike that balance.
Yeah, so we've only allocated about 5 minutes for each resolution, and we have a bunch more resolutions, and we're almost done with our extended time. So if you don't mind, would we be able to handle this next week? That
I just that.
Okay, one more suggestion.
Okay, so yeah. I worked a lot on that. I have a radical suggestion to get this out of the meetings and really get to what you're trying to do here. So like, I was thinking you could have the whereas.
Well, why don't we get together with the people?
Yeah, no, I just was going to suggest that you cut all the whereas except for one, which is, you know, the UA has the authority to examine matters. And then just go right into, therefore, be it resolved, the assembly requests that Cornell makes a commitment to ethical investing, that the university shares relevant information on investment partnerships. Skip the second further resolve, go to the third one, cut out expanding this collaboration, and then do lots to it. And that's it. That the budget planning committee, therefore, is charged with collaboration and coming up with a policy. Just cut out everything else, because then it would be overarching. And they could start to look at fossil fuel, they could look at the entire investment portfolio. And you wouldn't have to tie it to all these other, you know, this has been going on this application for a long time. So now you have a vehicle. So that's my suggestion for next week, if you could just get right to it. Please collaborate with this planning committee to share this information so we have the public.
great. So would you be able to connect with Linda?
Matt also was helped writing the draft. If he like has her, like, well, you're both on the UA, like if we could like start an email chain.
Just start an email chain and get things moving so that next week we can vote on it.
Great.
Okay. So thanks so much for being here. Good. Good to see you again. Okay, so we'll move on to resolution 15. Joe, you're the sponsor.
Yeah. So, I mean, this is just, it's an introduction today, so it's quick. Most people do not think the merger is a good idea. They think it's dumb. Also, it clouds the real discussion of actually having a beneficial discussion about the organizational structures of the social sciences. The resolution doesn't read this way right now, but I intend to bring amendments next week so it does read that way, where it's just asking to take the idea of the merger off the table and continue the listening series, but doing so in a more beneficial way, because I think that makes more sense. So the resolution does not read that way right now, so it'll be changed. So yeah, motion to table.
Okay, there's a motion to table.
Second.
There's a second. So there's no, is there dissent? Okay, because that wouldn't matter because it's a motion to table. So, okay, so resolution 15 is tabled.
Motion to go out of order, move to the addition of the CKC matter that is urgent.
Okay, so there's been a motion to take the UHRB late addition to the agenda and move that up in front of resolution 16. There's a second. Is there any dissent? All right, seeing no dissent, Matt, you have the floor about UHRB matters.
Thank you. A lot of cool things going on. This is related to our staff review boards. This meeting, we had hoped to have a resolution to pay the slate of UHRB members. Our state will work diligently to review applications. However, the office assemblies a couple of years ago unilaterally decided they wanted to anonymize the applications on our behalf without consulting or seeking our approval. They did this, and they announced that they won't give us the decoder key. So in essence, we have a number of anonymized applications. We don't know who they go to. They collected resumes in the application process that they won't give us. And the CDC had a subcommittee meet over this weekend to do an initial preliminary evaluation. And if we have a few that we think would be good to see, we have a number that we want to interview or otherwise follow up on. However, we can't do that because we don't know who we're contacting. I've requested the Office of the Assemblies to give us that key myself multiple times. Mr. Kaufman and Dave did as well as the chair. They keep telling us that it's contravening the policy. One, there is the policy. They have self-invented a policy that gives them this authority. And it's, in fact, at this point, it's actively impeding the work of the committee. Therefore, I wanted to ask this assembly to request information to instruct the office assemblies to give us the denomination key and resumes to include when they continue our work and hopefully you guys are reslinked by next meeting.
I second that motion and I call a question.
Okay, so there's been a second to have the Office of the Assemblies send the UHRB decoder to the Codes and Judicial Committee by when?
Within 24 hours of receipt. Within 24 hours of being contacted by the chair.
Okay, so within 24 hours. Okay, is there a second on the motion?
Okay.
There's a second. Okay, we'll now move into discussion on the motion.
Oh, question.
All right, there's a motion to call the question. I want to get a vote count on this. So if you're in favor of the motion, please raise your hand. If you're opposed to the motion, please raise your hand. And if you'd like to abstain. Okay, by a vote of 11-0-2, I will reach out to the office and correspond to that. Can we make sure that I get that exact wording correct? Yeah. All right.
A paraphrase.
Cool.
Is there exact language?
Yeah. I mean, okay. Another motion.
Noting the timeliness of the fact that we decided to voting on the CRPC tomorrow, I would motion that the chair of the assembly convey to the CRPC that there are some members of the assembly who are deeply concerned that the policy should be in the code. Because, and I didn't have a chance to do this, but talking about the table, this is in essence
part of this being tacked on is it should go to the committee and be put into the final report that goes to the president. And if it doesn't happen this week, it's a point. So I'm going to motion that at the very least, if you indicated there are some members who feel this way, so it goes somewhere and is not necessarily to the fault of the cracks.
Okay, so is that a motion for me is like tell Charlie that some people. Okay. So just a request.
Yeah, we don't need a motion.
Okay. Is there anyone not okay with me telling Charlie that some members of the UA want the policy to live in the code? No. Okay, and I'll tell them that. Great. Glad that we figured that out. So now we can move back into the resolutions. Resolution 6. Oh wait, no, we're out of time. So if there's no motion to
move to extend 15 minutes.
Okay. All right, great. Is there any dissent? Nope, 15 more minutes of fun it is. Resolution 16. Let's move on to resolution 16.
I move we table that for next meeting.
Okay, there's been a motion to table it. There's a second. It's a non-debatable motion. So if you're in favor of tabling the resolution, raise your hand.
Tell us what we're tabling.
Resolution 16.
16. Got it.
Yeah, resolution 16. Are we tabling? 16. If you want to discuss it more than we have discussed it, which is zero.
No, table 16.
Yeah. Okay. So we're going to vote on 16 and rather not to table 16. If you're in favor of tabling 16, raise your hand.
Tabling for next meeting, right?
Yep. Yeah. If you're opposed to tabling 16, raise your hand. Oh, great. Oh, boy. So I am going to not abstain. So I'm voting in favor of tabling. So we're tabling this resolution until the next meeting.
What is that vote?
Oh, 7 by a vote of 7-6-0. Yeah, 7-6-0. We're going to table it. I want to get out of here too, guys. Resolution 17.
This is a piece of cake, everybody. It's just a simple affirmation of the Congress Payne's resolution by the employee assembly. In order to strengthen something that was actually turned down by the president, to put our voices behind simple education about climate change. That's my speaking of it. You can look at it. It's a very short resolution.
Motion to table to the next
meeting. Is there any dissent to tabling? Okay, seeing no dissent to tabling, UA Resolution 17 is tabled until the next meeting. We will now move on to Resolution 18. Marty, do you have the floor again?
Same thing. This is just something that's been long coming. It's for the benefit of everybody in this room, for the benefit of every constituency, and the employee assembly asked for it for the benefit of the employees, and it was turned down once again because of lack of resources. So they're going on a piecemeal basis, taking care of this and that, but nothing comprehensive about how to get people to and from the destination, including students. And I suggest that we just pass it.
You mean table it?
No, pass. Oh, I don't want to table it.
Isn't it? It just got introduced today, though.
Okay, table. Yeah. Well, I'm not going to table it. Then if it's introduced today, we'll go on the next week.
Well, you still have to motion
to table. Okay. All right, there's been a motion to table. There's a second. Is there any dissent to tabling? Seeing no dissent to tabling, UA Resolution 18 is tabled, which actually exhausts our... never mind. JK, draft of code amendments.
Yes.
Matt, you have the floor.
Oh boy. Okay, I was bored. What happened?
Wow. It was recommitted.
12 was recommitted.
It was my mistake. Okay. So, thank you.
So, my bad. Code amendments. We have a lot of them. There's 10 here. The CDC is going to hold them office hours publicly at the CDC to talk about them, actually add some results. Then a question about how the UAV equipment goes. It's 10 questions, and I mentioned I'd be happy to walk through them now. I'm getting the consensus of the room that people might want to do that. So I'd be happy to, if you're interested, I can, or I can talk after. In essence, there's 10 of them. They're going to be broken into three separate resolutions. Language would still be written because I have been writing a lot of resolutions about the time I wish I had. But they are important. They are going there. In essence, the CDC has been very responsive this year. This year alone, we've met more than I think three or four. This year, we have met equivalent of over the past 3 years combined. This is your level. We've been very busy. We're working very hard. And this is the product of that. Something passed in the fall. They were brought back to the center. They were brought to the CDC. And the tweet, see community feedback. They're still seeking community feedback. Please circulate it to the constituencies because we need at the president policy that reject these based off graduating and community inputs. I'm also hopefully going to ask the office to use open for public comments that are already. But I'd have to answer any questions and talk about specific ones after the meeting going on for a long time.
Okay, any questions for Matt? No, then I'm actually going to, one thing that I think is important is, because the last time the amendments were rejected because there wasn't enough community feedback, I would strongly encourage people who represent assemblies on the UA to take these code amendments back to their constituent assembly and at least discuss them or see if people have any issues and then bring those back to the UA. So that's just advice that I would give so that we can maximize the community feedback. So that in the event that we pass them, we do not encounter a similar wall. Okay, so next is Appendix A. Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, draft of Appendix A amendments to the UA bylaws. Matt?
So as we did earlier with the main edition, we've had issues with UA with the staff in the past couple of years with the office assemblies. And of course, I don't like to say it publicly, we have. Every single year, we've had to fight with them over getting access to the denomination key. Always gotten it. Last year, there was some break of not confirming UA for BSLA. This year, they're late because we couldn't get the key. So to help avoid that, I am attempting to codify how we do UHRB for our bylaws. We have a staple down there saying, here's how we do it, here's our board, and it has to stay clear. This will ensure that the best practices we've developed in the past 5 or 6 years are codified, because believe it or not, that will be around forever. And also to ensure that there's no ambiguity when we tell the office assembly to give us information. For context, this year I met with Gina Giannettis, the director of the office. We sat down and set up a timeline for applications. That timeline got put back 3 weeks by her, which has now compressed our timeline and really put a crunch on the committee. This is trying to codify when we open applications, how we will do it, how we receive information, and what the role of the office is, and also clarify that the CJC has discretion. Again, hopefully minimize that we won't fight with the office assembly's point so much. It's relatively robust, necessarily making you, of course, have trouble with the office assemblies, but I'm happy to answer any questions or comments about it, either now or after maybe you want to call them.
Okay, so these are important. Think about these. It's a bylaws amendment, so we couldn't vote on it today even if we wanted to. But we can address that at the next meeting. Does anyone have any comments or questions about these?
I only have a suggestion.
Yeah.
And, we've had problems with communication with the office in years past, and I suggest that we take some action a little more forcefully in the next month or so. Before, you know, we can get somebody to go together to Joel's office and maybe even engage the president to think about it. But she did make a stand that she should be the chair of government. And the office assembly apparently is standing in the way of that.
Yeah. Alice, did you have a comment?
Just very quickly, seconding what Marty said. But that's happened with most of these things. The office of the assembly forgets that it serves us. We don't serve it. It's there to facilitate what we have to do. It doesn't make policy. It does what we ask it to do. And I think every now and then, Day Hall has to be reminded that they are there to make my life easier, you know, not for me to serve them because they are CEOs of the board.
All right. Thank you for expressing those sentiments.
We can vote on this the next time.
Yeah, we can vote on this the next time. So next, we will move on to the late additions to the agenda. Draft, even more. Okay, draft of code amendments.
These code amendments are currently being worked with the CDC. Myself and the executive committee met with the administration the first Monday back from the spring break. We had a discussion. Based on that, we drafted some language. The CDC discussed that language and proposed some changes. The administration has also proposed some changes. We're currently in the process of trying to reconcile those changes and also trying to schedule a follow-up meeting with the administration. It's a large change. In essence, the idea previous discussion was to move the JA away from a term-based appointment, a two-year term, more towards a as indefinite employment, subject to only termination by the assembly or some other form of matter for that, to add some more performance review, and to allow, as the truly assembly still have control and oversight of the JA, but to make it, which would find easier to attract talented individuals, primarily because the JA has served a two-year term for an option that is independent from the university, similar to the JCC, it's hard to attract talent. And therefore, the idea is to try and ensure the independence and oversight and still attract the talent. The language is very much in flux. I'd be happy to sit down and go over the actual details of anyone. It's very, again, we're pulling a lot of feedback in. Hopefully, we have something more concrete by next meeting, but I don't know if the assembly is aware of it. Myself, the CJC are working very diligently to meet that deadline as
they have under deadline. Yeah, from what I recall, and Elaine and I are checking, there was a May deadline. Was it the 1st of May?
It was at our meeting.
It was by the final meeting in May?
Yes.
Oh, okay, so then we still have some time. Okay, that's good. That's good. Okay, so with that, let's go into the late addition to the agenda, which is the addition of a meeting for next week. We clearly need a meeting next week, in my opinion, but I think we do. But so do people disagree with having a meeting next Tuesday? No? Okay, so by unanimous consent, we're going to schedule a meeting for next Tuesday. Yeah.
It's already been scheduled.
So, yeah. There's been a motion to adjourn the meeting. Is there any dissent to adjourning the meeting? Oh, right, right. Gina wanted to say something. Gina?
Hi, can everybody hear me?
Yes.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
So I've actually been on Zoom this meeting, and for much of the discussion about anything that involved the Office of the Assemblies, I felt like, you know, you certainly have time and space to ask questions of whether it's me or any of the staff here, but nobody did. And it was the last several statements by members of the assembly that were quite disparaging. And I feel it's I'd be happy to answer any questions that anybody has regarding what we do process-wise. There is never any intention to ever stand in the way of what the assemblies do, and how we support you is try to be as responsive to what your needs are. The case that Matt brought up is actually, I responded to him this afternoon, but that response was not conveyed to you. And regarding the timeline and the calendar, again, however you decide to propose amendments for the processes, we support those. There's nothing that I do that this office does to ever get in the way of that. What we do is support the processes that exist. And we do that, we work really hard to do that. So to the extent that you don't feel that you feel like there are, that whether it's me or the office is getting in the way or trying to come up with processes that circumvent your authority is absolutely not true. And I welcome opportunities to engage with you. The reason I'm not there today for your robust meeting is I was away from the office for 5 days, just back today, and still trying to get through emails. So my response to Matt's email that I got at 4 o'clock this afternoon was, great, let me make sure the provenance of whatever this policy is that we're talking about, because I can't imagine any situation when I would have unilaterally determined a process without it, particularly for the UA, but regardless for any of the assemblies, that would not have come from you or been approved by you. I oftentimes work in partnership to create language so it does what you want it to do, but we're the keeper of the policies. We don't do anything. We don't enforce them. We make sure that you know what they are. And when there are questions about it, we go back to the governing documents or the source of the policy. And that was my response to Matt this afternoon. So again, I welcome every opportunity. You certainly can and have go to you know, the folks that oversee shared governance here at Cornell. If you're dissatisfied with the support that this office gives, we absolutely, you know, you can do that. But I respectfully ask you to just let me know if there are things directly rather than a hearsay. So thanks for your time.
Just left. So Yeah, we lost quorum, so the meeting is adjourned. Thank you everyone for your time this evening. Could we turn that off? Yeah. I was gonna say, if anyone's interested in running for an executive position on the university assembly, feel free to contact me. I'm departing, but it seems like everyone departed before me.
I don't know.